Welcome to Life Quest, a program that directs you to subjects and books that will make a difference in your life. A program that will make you think and strengthen your journey of faith in the 21st century. My name is Dwight Lainhoff. Dr. Ken Druck has become a lifeline for thousands of families who've suffered a loss. He's often called upon to assist in the healing of tragic events such as 9/11, the shooting at Columbine High School, Hurricane Katrina. He's also an author of many books, and the one we're going to talk with him today about is called The Real Rules of Life, Balancing Life's Terms with Your Own. Welcome to LifeQuest.
Good to be with you today.
Tell me, why this book at this time?
You know, it has been a long journey for me this last season of my life. I think we take life in seasons, and this last season of my life started on a very tragic note with the death of my oldest daughter, Jenna. And for the last 15 years, I have headed up a nonprofit foundation helping families who've lost a child. It's been a long, interesting journey. In the process, I've learned so much, and I felt like I could take all this distilled essence, everything I've learned about how life really is, and distill it into a book. I could touch many more hearts, and that's what I've done. So the last couple of years, I sat down and I started putting to the pen so many of the ideas that I've shared with families and so many of the things I've learned from families after 9/11, after many tragedies, but also after great opportunities came true in their lives.
You call some of these things moments of truth.
They are moments of truth. We all arrive in them. We all get moments of, matter of fact, every day we have a moment of truth. If we really think about it, there's a moment where things become so crystal clear to us. Perhaps how much we love somebody in our family. Perhaps it's the acknowledgement and recognition of a burden that we've been carrying around for a long time, of something that's been causing us pain that we really need. It's time that we do something about it. And in these moments of awakening, our radar is really on. It's really sharp. It's really tuned in. And we need to pay attention and take advantage of these important insights.
There's something in us as human beings that says why. We get this idea that if we only know the answer to the why, it's somehow going to be less painful. It really isn't, though.
No, I think the why questions are often overrated. They say why questions are questions of infinite regress because there's always another why question behind it. Often it's better after a loss, tragedy, or a setback, or a challenge in our life to ask the what question, which is, what can I do to help myself move forward? How do I turn this adversity into a personal deepening, a spiritual deepening, an opportunity in my life to become the higher and better version of myself?
Your book is divided into chapters, which you call real rules. Why did you define them as real rules?
Well, you know, it was actually somebody who I was sharing the contents of my book with, and they said to me, you know, you're really describing how life really is. These are the kind of the real rules. This is what really happens in life. You know, life isn't fair. And yet again, in some ways, life is more than fair. What are we doing here, soaring on a little blue planet through space? You know, that life is so full of miracles, it's almost overwhelming. And the other thing you had mentioned about, you know, that we, you know, our faith and our sense of faith is that yeah, we do. A crisis and a setback and a hardship is sometimes the way we deepen our faith. It deepens our understanding of what forces are really at work. You know, what is God the force of in this life? Mm-hmm. Love? Goodness? Or is God the puppeteer who's watching over every single situation? And in my own situation, you know, I was so angry at God after my daughter died. I was so furiously angry. How could God let this happen? Until I could see a tear in the eye of God. I could see that God was crying with me, and that it was not this was not an act of God that took my daughter's life.
In your experience in dealing with a variety of people in a variety of situations, people react differently, don't they?
Yes, they do. They really do. Everybody, you know, we grieve as we live, and we all have different tools and different abilities to face into a moment of unknowingness, to face into a moment of confusion, of doubt, of sorrow, of loss. And we bring the best we have to those moments. But ideally, what we're supposed to do is we're supposed to become stronger in the broken places, that we take what's happened to us and we turn it into an expression of understanding, of compassion, and we grow stronger as human beings. We grow more able and capable of understanding and dealing with life the way it really is.
In Chapter 3, Real Rule 3, you say there's no deals. We kind of like to make deals, don't we?
We're deal makers from the get-go. You know, we want something for something. We want to believe that the world is completely orderly and that if we do A, we'll get B. But that's just not the way it works out. You know, how many of us know that parents who are the most wonderful parents in the whole world, they couldn't be more loving, they couldn't be more giving or supportive to their kids,
mm-hmm.
and their kids are somehow one day strung out on drugs.
Yeah.
Their kids are getting into trouble with the law, and people go, how could this possibly happen? Well, you can do the best you can, and things don't work out. There are no deals. Life has its own terms. It's beyond us at times to understand why things work out the way they do, but there are no guarantees. Nobody has an exemption card. Nobody gets a get-out-of-jail card. We all have to go through whatever life is we have to go through.
One of the rules here is life is designed to break your heart. As I mentioned earlier before we began this interview, I'm dealing with my daughter whose heart is broken, and you're saying that's life.
You know what? Anybody who's put their heart on the line, whether it's for a marriage, being a parent, where we learn how to wear our hearts outside of our bodies,
mm-hmm.
Whether it's creating a business, whether it's helping build a community, whether it's cultivating a beautiful family, realizes that there is going to be heartache. And I think we give heartache a bad rap. You know, heartache is simply, you know, the time that it doesn't work out, and it doesn't always work out. Sometimes we're standing in a moment of disappointment, of despair, and we feel entitled. Like, what went wrong? How come what did I do? Or what's wrong? I have no deal here. And we need to realize that sometimes things just don't work out. Sometimes our hearts get broken. This is the price of loving and caring and investing ourselves to make something wonderful happen.
In dealing with things, we sometimes say that time heals all wounds. Time is a very flexible thing for some people. Some people seem to take a long time. I liked the beginning of Chapter 7, where you tell about a meeting you had with some high school kids where it wasn't a Columbine type of tragedy, but they had a lot of their fellow classmates die.
There were 13 deaths in this one school, and right outside of San Diego. And the high school counselor, who was an old buddy of mine, said, "Ken, would you come? You know, we don't want to do the drunk driving assembly. We don't want to do the assembly about don't discriminate against other people. We need to do an assembly about grief and loss.
Mm-hmm.
These kids are reeling. They don't know how to deal with it. And frankly, we're not sure how to help them, what we should say to them." So I did this assembly, and the first thing I did, I started with, and I know as a dad you'll relate to this, is I apologized to all of them. I said, "You know what? My generation has taught all of you kids that there's a pill for every pain. There's a diversion for every moment of emptiness. There's a fix for every problem. But the truth is, it's not so.
Mm-hmm.
That sometimes we just hurt. Sometimes our hearts break. We stand in a moment of sorrow, and I'm so sorry that you have lost so many of your classmates. It just flat out sucks."
Mm-hmm.
Using their vernacular,
right,
their language, I said, "It sucks, and there's no spin. I'm not here to tell you it shouldn't. I'm here to share your sorrow with you and to tell you that there are certain things we can do with sorrow and certain things that we ought not to do with sorrow, and that when we process grief and loss, and when we talk out and we allow these things to work their way through our system, they become things that make us better people. When we try to sublimate them, hide them, deny them, repress them, pretend they don't exist or avoid them, the unprocessed grief turns to indifference, numbness, and even sometimes violence.
And they listen to you.
And they listen to me. I had all of the, I was amazed. I looked out. How did I get their attention? How did I earn and deserve? But they did, and we then, after the assembly, we broke into all classrooms, and we went around to each classroom and let the kids ask questions, because, you know, the most important thing in communicating with kids is the indication of it is that we have scar tissue on our tongue from all the places we've bitten our tongue.
Right.
To just listen to kids, and the kids themselves also had wonderful ideas about how they could process through their grief and loss, how they could memorialize and honor their friends who they had lost by doing good things in their name.
And that leads me to another one of the real rules, number 8, listening is love. But, you know, I want to tell my kids everything, or I want to tell a person in grief, here's what you've gone through, here's why. But you're saying, no, it's the listening part.
Listening is the most powerful gift we can give to another human being. It's the precursor for love. And there's nothing that we can give, no greater gift than for a human being to look back at us and say, boy, he really understands, or she really gets it. That feeling of connection that we have with other people that gives us the sense that we're not alone, that somebody else has taken a moment to step in our shoes and understand how the world looks from our perspective, even if they disagree with it. That sign of respect and caring is the basis for all good things that happen in human relationships.
But that's kind of hard.
It's very hard sometimes. Sometimes that's where the scar tissue on the tongue comes in, where we need to bite our tongue and realize that being a safe, silent presence and a witness to what somebody's going through is the best thing in the world to help them. Not rescuing them, not bailing them out, not enabling them, not trying to figure out and fix them, but just being a witness, standing with them, having the faith in them that they're going to find a way out of this. And when they ask for help, then being available.
Yeah.
Solicited answers and solicited help is always the best kind of help. Helping somebody who doesn't want to help themselves ends up nowhere. Our power to understand, to have faith and support other people without pushing them, to be there with them, is the most powerful, loving thing we can do as dads, as husbands, as sons, and as partners, as associates in business.
I'm Dwight Lainhoff. I'll be back in just a moment.
Joining us today on Life Quest, here is host Dwight Lainhoff.
In personal tragedies, in national tragedies, we hear often this term closure. We have to make closure. We have to find closure. You suggest straight away that it's a big myth.
Closure is not only at times useless; it's actually dangerous because these things recycle back. It's not a sign of failure or inadequacy or the fact that we haven't handled something. We internalize it and personalize it as a failure when, in fact, everything has a season. You know, I have not stopped thinking about my daughter. I grieve. I think about her every day. And these thoughts and these feelings recycle through at a higher level so that we can find higher ways of dealing with them. Mm-hmm. That's not a sign of failure. And to tell somebody, oh, you're not getting closure, sends the wrong message. It sends mm-hmm. a message. They think something's wrong with them because they're still having these feelings. There's nothing wrong. Our emotional radar is still working. It's still operating. If we get stuck, we can ask for help. There are ways we can dislodge ourselves and move ourselves forward. And that's one of the reasons I wrote this book, was to help people who are stuck find a path forward. That's why there are exercises at the end of every chapter. If somebody really wants to create movement forward in their lives, that is the purpose.
Now, what is the difference between what you just described and letting go? You say we need to know when it's time to let go.
Yes. You know, there is a fine line at which we need to recognize. There's a point at which sometimes the most powerful thing we can do to resolve a conflict is to let go. Let go of our sense that we are in control. We don't get to play God. Sometimes being on our knees with humility and surrendering and saying, you know what, I don't get to control this. God, give me the strength to realize the difference. You know, the Serenity Prayer is one of the most mm-hmm. powerful statements of learning how to create peace and find peace within ourselves that I've ever heard. And it really is understanding that there are some things in this life I can't control, and those things I need to let go. I need to let God. I need to understand there are forces at work that are much greater than I that are handling this, and it's not in my hands. It's in hands bigger than mine.
In your book, you also talk about a lot about somehow whether it's incidents like with my parents' generation, it was Pearl Harbor or 9/11, perhaps in ours, and that we get focused on those things. In fact, I got to tell you, I've stopped starting the day turning on the Today Show because I don't want to know all the horrible things that are happening in the world because we have so much more information now than we used to. So there are some boundaries that we can put, correct?
We have to be good self-managers. We now have access. We have breaking news on our cell phones, and it's going to get worse. We're going to have breaking news in the sky. I mean, it's going to be all around us. So how we manage our intake of news, especially when most of the news that's brought to us is bad news.
Right.
It's the worst, horrific, most horrible thing that's happened on the planet today. And our nervous systems, if we feed ourselves bad news all the time, guess what? Let's do the math. What do you think is going to happen to us?
Mm-hmm.
Our system's built to be able to cope with us. So we need to get out into nature. We need to nurture ourselves with good news, be a part of good things happening in our communities, be part of the solution, rather than sitting as in a spectator sport, listening to and ingesting all the bad news about things that went sideways in the world.
So whether it's a national, international tragedy, whether it's a personal grief or tragedy that is happening with us, it's okay to be joyful, and it's not rejecting that tragedy by moving forward.
You know, one of the most difficult things I ever have had to learn, because after my daughter died, I felt like, well, how dare I enjoy one more morsel of food?
Right.
How dare I enjoy anything in this life when my daughter has lost her life has been lost to her?
Mm-hmm.
And until I realized that how critical, that every time I feel joy, she feels joy. Every time I listen to music, her heart sings.
Yeah.
That joyfulness, that our job, even after a tragedy, is to make the rest of our lives count for something, to do something good with our love, not with our despair over the loss, but with our love for the person we've lost. And to use that love in the world by being joyful, by seeing beauty, by seeing the goodness in life, and not only seeing it, witnessing it, but being a part of it and contributing to it. And that's what I've tried to make my life the last 15 years.
Ken, how do you want your readers to use this book?
You know, I at first I thought this was a book just for people who needed a more than a hug or a greeting card and who are going through a real rough stretch in life. But I've soon realized, because I've been getting feedback from all over the world, we just sold the book in Korea, China, Portugal, I've been hearing from people all over the world that these are life lessons, that finally somebody's telling the truth about how life really is, and that it's very grounding, it's very helpful, it's allowing them to grow their souls, it's allowing them to be stronger in the way they face into this life. So I think that's my overall goal, that's my prayer for this book, is that it touches people's hearts, it sets off their capacity to love and to embrace this life, and to understand that life is going to have its own say, but that shouldn't stop them from fiercely defining the best of the best that they can do in this life and in their own families.
The book is The Real Rules of Life, Balancing Life's Terms with Your Own, by Dr. Ken Druck. That's D-R-U-C-K. Where can people get this book, Ken?
You know, anybody, it should be in any bookstore around the country. People can order it on Amazon.com. And if anybody's having a problem finding the book for any reason, they can go to our website, kendruck.com, www.kendruck.com. And we'll help them find the book. Melissa in my office is becoming an expert at doing that. And some of the Costcos around the country are also carrying the book as well.
Ken, thanks so much for being with us today on LifeQuest.
What an honor to be a part of your program, and thank you for the contribution you make on a regular basis.
Thanks for listening to LifeQuest today. If you have questions or comments, you may send them to lifequest@lifetalk.net. Or write to LifeQuest at P.O. Box 33082, Knoxville, Tennessee 37930.